All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Welcome. We're fashionably late as usual. Me and John was messing about with buttons and things. Welcome to John Bowd's All the Rage here on www.traxfm.org. This week, John will be discussing the ongoing struggle, shall we say, on Amazon and its current campaign to form a union in the workplace. John?
Thanks. Yeah, we've got a few things to cover this week, but we're going to begin with a shout-out and solidarity to Pamela Fitzpatrick, who has been expelled from the Labour Party a week or so, well, about 2 weeks ago now, actually, for supposedly giving an interview to a subscribed group. This is the usual bullshit from the worst people in the world. As we discussed on the show before, the Labour Party is being led by people so extreme in their political bias and hatred of the public that they wage an internal war on their best and most committed people in the middle of an international health crisis and a national meltdown. Pamela is one of the finest councillors Labour has ever seen, and what any Labour representative should be, a committed socialist who will move heaven and earth for the needs of the most vulnerable. She is obviously our original OG guest on this show, and we have a hell of a lot of time for her. She was on a couple of weeks ago, actually, and I'll be even be referring back to some of the things she mentioned then. So it's just disgusting, frankly, that the Labour Party are treating their best people like this, and they're an absolute disgrace. And we need to get these parasites out of power for good, because really they're just the same as the Tories. I've got no time for them. Okay, so yeah, as Dave said, we're going to be talking about a few trade union things this evening on the show, and we're going to be mentioning Amazon. But before we get there, there's a couple of other things I would like to mention. Firstly, there is the issue in the UK right now of the potential threat to citizenship. Clauses have been added to the Nationality and Borders Bill that quietly gives permission to remove British citizenship without notice. This means individuals could see their citizenship removed without warning. According to The Guardian, Clause 9, Notice of Decision to Deprive a Person of Citizenship, of the bill, which was updated earlier this month, exempts the government from having to give notice if it is not reasonably practicable to do so, or in the interests of national security, diplomatic relations, or otherwise in the public interest. That's the end of that quote. Now, this is already a very contentious power. Francis Weber, the vice chair of the Institute of Race Relations, said that this, quote, this amendment sends the message that certain citizens, despite being born and brought up in the UK and having no other home, remain migrants in this country. Their citizenship, and therefore all of their rights, are precarious and contingent. It builds on the previous measures to strip British-born dual nationals, who are mostly from ethnic minorities, of citizenship and to do it while they are abroad, measures used mainly against British Muslims. It unapologetically flouts international human rights obligations and basic norms of fairness. That's the end of her quote. This joins a line of increasing powers against foreign-born people in Britain, no matter their actual status or of citizenship. It means the Home Secretary could remove your citizenship in secret and deny you an appeal. In the words of Maya Four from Reprieve, quote, under this regime, a person accused of speeding would be afforded more rights than someone at risk of being deprived of their British nationality. This once again shows how little regard this government has for the rule of law. The end of that quote. And this is at this the major point, really, here, as far as I'm concerned. Regardless of what you might think of any of this, it is unlawful. That is, the government are breaking the law. This all comes on top of proposals to make anyone arriving here illegally an inadmissible claim and making it illegal to help people in need, such as those in the water, while also making it legal for Border Patrol to kill them in the process of doing their job. What we see here is a textbook reason for a fair system that is not changed because you like someone or a group of people or you don't like them. It is very beneficial for a government wanting to remove our rights to have someone like Shemima Begum, for example, popping up in the news while middle-aged white wash-ups sneer at her and get angry. She is a female Muslim who fled Britain to join the Islamic State, so right there you can lean on ideas of treason or hating Britain or any of that stuff, while the people who supposedly love this country continue to take away the rights and freedoms for all of its citizens. While allowing this hate and judgment into your thinking, we all lose rights in the process, the very epitome of divide and conquer. It never ceases to amaze or disgust me how easily people will give away their freedoms while talking about what a wonderful free country we all live in. You not only hate people you have never met, you also hate yourself. We have a severe hard right government in power right now, and they have an agenda to attack our citizenship and make life much worse for everybody, especially the most vulnerable. And the limp dick opposition will do absolutely nothing to change this, even if they had the power to do so. It would be good to see some meaningful response to this, some organising to oppose it all and hopefully defeat this terrible bill. Trade unions are in a very strong position to lead on this, among others. So that's the first aspect I want to talk about, and I'll just go into the next one before me and Dave maybe discuss this in a little bit more detail, because the two relate quite well. Refugee rights. At the time of me recording this and speaking about it, there is a major threat to the lives of the most desperate people who are basically in the position of committing the crime of being born abroad and becoming victims of terrible circumstances. The Home Office has taken their war against refugees to new levels of depravity, and they have the audacity to claim that they are saddened by the tragic deaths seen in the Channel recently, even though they are directly responsible for this happening. The UK government recently approved their border force to engage in pushbacks in the Channel, that is, forcing vulnerable boats full of people to turn around in the middle of the sea, a very dangerous and highly populated sea, as it is, with lots of... Well, I say lots of delivery stuff, you know, trade passing between the two. I don't think we're seeing quite as much of that at the moment, if the supermarket shelves or anything to go by, but that's another story and not something to whine about here. It's a bit of a first world problem. Anyway, a highly dangerous activity turning around these boats that often leads to capsizing of said boats and death. And seeing as they have tried to make it illegal to save people who are illegally in these waters, if it's possible to be in a water illegally, they are clearly making it even more likely that these people will drown. They are, in fact, so certain of this that they have pushed legislation to prevent prosecution of their Border Force employees for anything that they do whilst doing their job. This would not, they would not need to do this, frankly, if there were no chance of them doing something terrible towards someone seeking refuge. They've done it because they know that this is going to happen, and they're trying to precede any kind of prosecution of Border Force people for killing someone. The UK has also criminalised undocumented arrival in the UK, which is in violation of the Refugee Convention. Doing this when they know the risks prove that this government are committing acts likely to lead to death, manslaughter at the very least, but straight up state-sanctioned murder in my book. What's more, this is likely another illegal action, breaking many international laws that Britain is signed up to, including those requiring captains at sea to help people who are in distress. And this is a very important point, folks. Many foreign haters and white supremacists in the UK hide behind things like the rule of law as an excuse, often to justify their carelessness and savagery towards refugees and migrants, claiming that they are in support of legal routes and all this kind of stuff. But right here, their beloved country, as it were, is breaking the law. Laws we are supposed to have improved control over since leaving the EU, some of whom member states have been found to have turned back at least 40,000 people during the COVID-19 pandemic, using multiple illegal practices that have led to the deaths of more than 2,000 people. While we are on the subject of the law, whatever you have been told, there is no legal imperative for asylum seekers to stay in the first safe country that they arrive in. I know you hear that a lot, but I assure you that's not actually the case. 73% of asylum seekers do stay in countries neighbouring the one that they've actually just fled. However, the UN Refugee Convention doesn't mandate that this has to happen, nor does it allow governments to penalise them for unlawful entry in certain circumstances. 85% of refugees are hosted presently in developing countries. So again, European countries are being irresponsible little buggers, and all of this while crying about not being able to cope whenever it suits them. Meanwhile, Britain is breaking the law, despite the fact that so many of its lovers proclaim that they love the rule of law so very much. You don't seem to like it too much in this case for some strange reason. The political actors involved on both sides of the Channel do not care in the slightest. And sadly, they're looking to appeal to the repulsive voter bases that they have at their hate-filled worst, absolutely the lowest common denominator of inhumanity. They are playing games while people die, cheap political games that cost people their lives. The media are one of the biggest enemies to the right to life for the most vulnerable people, from refugees to trans people and even those on benefits. The UK accepts a woefully low number of refugees anyway, but still the media scream and cry about this, talking about floods and swarms and all this other stuff, which is often repeated by prime ministers and the like in the House of Commons, among other places. One of whom actually talked about a bunch of migrants on International Holocaust Day, which was a wonderful factor. Never forgive, never forget, Mr. Cameron. While the rest of Europe and many other countries around the world take in far more refugees, this is still Britain's position. Apparently we're being flooded, etc., etc. The legal routes are intentionally difficult at best and made harder to access. This is actually something Pamela was talking about a few weeks ago when she was on this show, once again being decent enough to share her great knowledge and experience of this sort of subject with all of us. They revolve around the idea of only being able to claim asylum if you make it to Britain, then they make it as difficult as possible to get to Britain. It's a really tragic and indecent way to treat people. Meanwhile, in Calais, there have been a higher level of reported migrant deaths in recent time. Less known right now, because again it's being ignored, the refugee deaths taking place in Calais are quite the numbers might not necessarily be high, but what does that matter? Around 3 weeks ago, three men were reported missing after trying to cross the channel in a kayak, adding to at least five people going missing since the start of October, and two are known to have drowned. Additionally, two have died in lorry accidents, and at least one was hit by a train. According to the Care for Calais charity, not a single body of the missing has so far been recovered. For the majority of this year, police and politicians have carried out a systematic assault on refugees on both sides of the channel. Well worth remembering details like this when people claim France is a safe country for refugees and they should stay there, or talk about how generous and good-hearted Britain is. Good-hearted countries would not have anti-refugee bills like this one does, or the abusive police force of France, among other things. French border authorities have tried to stop distribution of food and clothing by aid charities too. It has been about 5 years since the refugee camp in Calais that was then known as the Jungle was destroyed by French authorities, but organisations, including Human Rights Watch, that are still around, say there are still around 2,000 people there, including 300 unaccompanied children living there in wooded areas, abandoned warehouses and under bridges. So, let go of that meaningless resentment towards people you know nothing about and those who are substantially more vulnerable and involved in a lot more suffering than you will ever be. Because while it does absolutely nothing for you, it is literally killing them. This dehumanisation really does have to stop. You can donate, by the way, to Care for Calais, and you can volunteer with them. There's a link included in the show description. So, Dave, citizenship threats, refugee attacks, where are we with this?
I can't believe we're still going on about this chestnut at the moment. I don't know who... When politicians decide this, I don't know who they're actually trying to appease. Are they trying to appease the poor, which is a lot, by saying you're poor because of immigrants or migrants or whatever? Are you saying that you can't get a job because of migrants? And have you been to places like Morocco, Dubai, Middle Eastern countries, lovely countries, beautiful people, or do you think they're all living in huts and the sand? Because I tell you something, try it, it's lovely, it's beautiful, and they're lovely people, and they welcome you, and families means a lot to them, and they're very affluent in a lot of those areas. Syria, people coming here were actually very professional, they were doctors, lawyers, and they had something to give society. And just on that, in regards to jobs, me and John are in a 500-year-old plus service, and we've continually relied on a large network called long-distance drivers and vehicles. You'll see them on the road. I won't say the name, but they're red. And you'll see them all your life. We can't get people to take these jobs anymore. And it's not just in our industry, we're seeing it in the long haulage industry across the country. And it's got to a point where our industry is actually delivering food to supermarkets because they're using our network. So who are these politicians appeasing? Who's their constituents that are saying, look all around me, look, all these migrants, you know, who are you appeasing? Because I'm seeing the other end of the scale, and the indigenous population here, I'm sorry to say it, they don't want to work. They don't want to work. They don't want to deliver mail. They don't want to work in the supermarkets. They don't want to pick fruit. So we'll get other people to do it. Oh, no, we can't do that. We've stopped them. Over 60% of our nurses are from abroad in this country. Who wants to wipe someone's arse all day? Which is what they do. People who suffered COVID have come back differently and have a different view on the NHS, and they're saying these people are beautiful, they're wiping my arse and everything. I was dying in there. Filipino nurses, Nigerian nurses, Asian nurses. So let's stop all that, shall we? Let's just stop all that, and who's going to do it? It turns out, let's look at ourselves in the mirror, people that are born here, i.e. the two people talking here. Some of us don't want to do that, do we, John?
I wouldn't quite go as far as to say the indigenous population don't want to work. I don't mind saying that because it's a bit of a laugh. But I do think that it's very important to actually get a sense of class analysis and class solidarity going on here, because that's the wider point to me. You know, you want to talk about the world being unfair. You want to talk about you not getting your equal share. You want to talk about getting ripped off. Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And Dave and I are trade union reps, so we know this stuff. Okay. But you're not being ripped off by Johnny Foreigner coming over on a boat, whether it's a legal or illegal one. Okay. And secondly, I will distance ourselves from the idea of all... this is a funny one, Dave. They talk about the idea of, some of these people aren't refugees, they're economic migrants. Well, what does that even mean? Because if you come here under any whatever circumstances, you go to a place, you have to get a job, you have to make money. That's a system, that's a beloved capitalist system that you people desire and lust after so much. It's the reason you've just had your big Black Friday. You know, you have to do that. You have to give people money for the pleasure of living in whatever shitty room they rent to you. You have to give out money in order to eat. So, firstly, a refugee and an asylum seeker and an economic migrant are all kind of separate things, right? And they're not, you know, even if people were coming here for money, I don't care. For one thing, I have a certain degree of admiration for someone who's that willing and that dedicated, and I think they need to be given a reward of some description for doing so. But, you know, what somebody needs, when somebody needs asylum, when somebody needs refuge, that's nothing to do with economic needs. Now, the fact they might have economic needs when they get it like the rest of us, fine, but it is about it's things like investment. It's about people. You know, no one has been on the dole for 20 odd years purely because they just couldn't be bothered. They don't have the same opportunities. The areas they live in are underfunded. The people they live around are brutalized and beaten back by the terrible class war of the last 40 years. And really, you know, it's us against them. But the problem is, you're picking the wrong them. You need to pick on the rich. You need to pick on the Boris Johnsons of the world and all of his friends, and all of those staggeringly incapable people that were getting juicy government contracts during the worst time, the worst health epidemic for 100 years. And these absolute useless dipshits were getting, you know, nice juicy contracts and not even delivering the goods. And it was the rest of us that were suffering. And what's something that has been, you know, productive, what has been beneficial in this country, is the vaccine rollout. It's done very, very well with, you know, as Dave just pointed out, a tremendous amount of a mix of working class people, including those from all over the world, who have had the decency to come here and take care of you and take care of me. And we must have talked about this on the show more times than I can remember. We just keep coming back to it. I just don't know why. I mean, I do, but theoretically, I don't know why we keep coming back to it. It's so sad and so pointless. And people are dying. People are now dying because of your indecent ideas and attitudes about them. They're dying because you keep repeating these disgusting, hateful, tabloid lies about them all being, you know, mass murdering, pit bull terrier owning, AIDS infected, economic migrants, blah, blah, blah. Well, fuck you.
Well, John, decency. I think what we've got to look over our shoulder, and I do take that back, about people don't want to work here.
It's all right to have a laugh. I mean, fair enough. We're not all
totally serious. No, it's not. Most of them. Right? No, I'm being honest, right?
Yeah.
What it is, people are angry because the social security system, they're on universal credit. They're getting a squeeze on that, right? And it is bad, right? They're calling that whole department in the Department of Work and Pensions. They're not actually calling it social security. They're calling it debt management assistance, yeah. Right? So you're getting the squeeze on that. So for years you've been on the rock and roll, and you're getting the squeeze on that, and you don't want to do service industry work or what you believe is menial, and you want high-paying jobs. And if it exceeds what you're claiming, then you'll go for it, but you're happy as you are. But hang on a minute, I'm getting the squeeze here. Let me make this very clear about politicians and migrants or whatever they pluck out of the air, they can get one or two votes extra. It could be you next. They'll pick a subject. They'll tell their mates in the papers, this is what you get on universal credit. And then they'll pull the plug on it and they'll get the papers to support them on that. Beware. It's you next. They'll just pluck something out of the ear and they'll get you here and that will get you in the end. Be careful. 1 minute it's migrants or immigrants or asylum seekers taking our jobs, and I think they'll go in House of Commons tomorrow and say, look at these people playing PS5 and they're born here and he's getting £40 a week. Why would he need a job for? We should be, you know, they'll do anything to get a vote, and it could be you next, John.
Yes, and both major parties are aiming at the same group of people for some reason. It's because, well, I know for one reason, because they're the ones most likely to vote. And they're basically shutting you and I out, which has got to be said is and I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I? But it also happens to be true. This is exactly opposite what Corbyn did. Corbyn wanted the votes of absolutely everyone. He wanted the votes of people who hadn't voted for years, in some cases never, because he wanted them to be included within society and to actually have a stake in everything that we're doing. And it's right. It's a right move. I support that.
These buggers, this mainstream establishment, the mega rich, will never have the problems that you and I am and all these people are having.
No.
They'll never ring up a debt service management and say, yes, you've lost your job, when can you pay us back? They'll never have that issue. But they don't want someone who's going to get a high turnout. They do not want that. And in 2030, I'll say it again, we will have a coalition government. And that's how we'll be from day dot, because the people that they're appealing to about asylum seekers or whatever they pluck out the air, whoever they can pick on, they'll be dead. John?
Yeah, and in the tradition of us just having a bit of a laugh, good. Well, won't be missed. So, yes, your pathetic, somber little generation who are so sad that they never had a war to go to. Oh. Go home and watch 40 Towers until you expire. Anyway, no, I'm just, jokes aside, as we talked about this when David Rosenberg was on last night. We talked about class analysis, and absolutely we're not looking for divisions in any age groups like that. But you will get a ribbon from me. Come on, it's the least you can take. Fair enough. Okay, so that's one issue. Let's move on to something else that also concerns me before we get to the big Amazon issue. Holocaust denial in Texas. There is a bill currently being pushed by a Dallas public school to, quote, offer material on other perspectives, end of quote, when teaching about the Holocaust. The only other material that exists on this subject, that is alternative view on this terrible and appalling slaughter, is basically denial. Finally, the teach all sides of any issue shit has come home to its logical conclusion. Gina Peddy, an official with the Carroll Independent School District, northwest of Dallas, told teachers to make sure that if you have a book on the Holocaust, that you have one that has an opposing, that has other perspectives, according to an audio that was released by NBC. Staffers were audibly incredulous about this, prompting Peddy to cite House Bill 3979, a law signed in June that requires social studies teachers who discuss controversial issues in the classroom to strive to explore the topic from diverse and contending perspectives without giving deference to any one perspective. That's a direct quote. On top of this, the district said it is also trying to navigate another state law known as Senate Bill 3 that's set to take effect in December and requires teachers in subjects other than social studies to discuss controversial topics objectively. A rule the school system believes applies to classroom libraries too. A subsequent Facebook post from the district stated they understand, quote, there are not two sides of the Holocaust, end of quote, and now believe that HB 3979 doesn't apply to historical events, perhaps not this time around, but keep your eyes on this because it will come back. It is already likely that it could be used against critical race theory or what's also known as white people whining about learning how evil they have been throughout their entire lives, as we call it in my house. One author of HB 3979 is Republican State Representative Steve Toth, and he said he feels the bill is clear in applying explicitly to current events, as he's put it, widely debated and currently controversial issues. How is it that modern issues become controversial? Tell you what, we'll come back to that in a minute. Toth went on to say he thought this issue had been politicised. How is it not political, you fucking dimwit? Naturally, you could not possibly politicise an issue so clearly political as the one this is whenever it applies to anything, really. He also claimed it applies to in-class topics and not school libraries, but again, this is a distraction, really. If he has any brain, he knows this perfectly well. The author of SB3 is State Senator Brian Hughes, also a Republican, and he said his bill doesn't require teachers to equivocate on historical facts like the Holocaust. Quoting here, our teachers are empowered and expected to call evil for what it is. We trust them to do that. Okay, well, capitalism's in for a rough ride, isn't it? Hughes wrote in a statement to Forbes magazine. Okay, so there's a bit of a to and fro going on here, which I included there, in obviously, for you to kind of understand the issue better. But let's just drill down into this a little bit more, the real reason I want to talk about it more than anything else. What this is really about is pushing the envelope to see how far it will go. Not just in relation to anti-Semitism, the real stuff this time, but if they can get away with it towards even more vulnerable people or any other group that they can do this to. This is happening in a climate of increased white supremacist reaction all over America, where many in that community are praising the likes of Viktor Orban in Hungary, where his overt anti-Semitism is far more prevalent. They really are just kind of hoping that they can get away with it, I think, under the radar, and because it's not like America's a country that doesn't suffer from anti-Semitism. It suffers from all forms of hatred, and it doesn't take much digging in any of the issues on the right wing to find it. I mean, even the anti-vax movement right now, you know, you don't have to dig too far to find George Soros conspiracy theorists and Rothschild bankers and all this shit. HB 379 says social studies teachers in Texas can't be required to discuss any, quoted, controversial issue of public policy or social affairs, end of quote. So if teachers choose to talk about controversial topics, they need to offer diverse perspectives, and they cannot suggest a particular race is superior or deserving of guilt, according to this law. Not the same thing. Not morally comparable. The idea of a particular race being superior, or the idea that guilt is something that's applied to another group of people, for whatever reason, which is backed up by a tremendous amount of historical fact. What this, I think, means in reality is no matter what the law specifies, teachers could easily slip into territory that proves difficult or that students or parents end up complaining about and make a big political issue over it. So in effect, it actually shuts down debate as nobody wants to touch the subject because they just think if they bring it up, it's going to become just far too problematic and may even be a risk to their job. Not to mention the idea of death threats and all the other stuff that tends to crawl out from under the woodwork when these things go public. When the Texas House passed the bill earlier this year, Toth, in fact, framed it as a prohibition on critical race theory. He actually said the quiet part loud. A decades-old academic concept that explores systematic racism in the US legal and social context, in which many in America, whether they are institutional or individual, are deeply resistant to right now because they really do have a serious problem with discussing their own history. The bill is part of a wave of legislation in Republican-controlled states restricting how teachers discuss race. Toth told Forbes magazine, I think it was a magazine or the website, that his bill requires teachers to ask kids to think critically instead of brainwashing them. Brainwashing them by telling them the Holocaust is evil, I guess. Meanwhile, opponents in Texas have castigated this legislative push, arguing that restrictions make it tougher for teachers to lead difficult conversations and could cause schools to deliver a muddled message on challenging parts of American history. Yeah, you could say that again. Okay, there's a bit more here, but I think that I don't want to go into too much because I think we've kind of covered it, really. Dave, where are you on this?
Well, again, it's just one of those things. I sometimes wake up in the morning, John, and think, what else is there, you know, that we traditionally live with on isms and there's always another ism, isn't there? I don't know if people just need have had a whack on the head or something. are they reading publications? Or it's hard to say, John, because the new isms that I'm waking up to every day seem to be sometimes, not all the time, sometimes mainstream media led. But John, you know the score.
Yeah, I mean, just a couple of other things on this. So this isn't just me sounding off on this. Apparently, the Carroll Independent School District board reportedly issued a letter of reprimand to a fourth grade teacher who displayed "This book is anti-racist," which is the name of a book, in the classroom. That's one situation where it's come up. And the school district also rolled out training recently on classroom reading materials. So the district said this training session was designed to discuss best practices and help teachers grapple with SB3 and HB3979. So it's obviously already having an effect on the ground. So while the question of the Holocaust is definitely present here, and fuck what the defenders of this bill say, that's exactly what they're doing, which again is a far-right white supremacist trope, it would not be the first time. It's also a bit, I think it's a bit of a stalking horse, really. They've either done this on purpose, or the writers of the awful bills are just taking advantage of a situation that's arisen. But I think the intent really is the same, to get everyone rightly angry and focused on this while something else comes through later that's just as bad but doesn't capture the public attention in quite the same degree. For instance, as I say, we know that the dreaded critical race theory is being made controversial to prevent discussing troublesome topics like American history and racism. And they're still going to be there, whether you discuss them or not, and nothing ever gets better by you ignoring it. But whichever way you look at it, it's really a nasty attempt to shut down any real discussion, I think, of American history, which is often hidden within attempts to shut down critical race theory or any of the rest of that. I really struggle to actually even find out what the bloody hell critical race theory is, as far as a definition. I don't know, have you come across it?
No, and that's what I'm saying, John. You know, look, let's take the layers off this shite. Excuse my French.
Yeah.
I believe in the mantra, knowledge is power. I'm not the only one, because the establishment also recognise knowledge is power. And the last place they want that knowledge is right at a child's first few days or first few years of their seat of learning, because they may grow up and have a different outlook and change things and you know, look at a superpower, which turns out through the 80s and 70s, it turns out it wasn't a superpower at all. It was just as much poverty as the third world.
Yeah.
A terrible mortality rate. Terrible infant death. You know, it's not a superpower. And let's get the truth out and look at change and how we can change things. Or we'll end up keep voting in a right-wing government or right-wing people with tendencies that we laughed at 10 years ago. And then we wonder how Capitol Hill happened. You know, how did that happen? Because it is the biggest trick in the book. It's fear, divisiveness, hate, poverty, all the things that poverty is the most common thing, and it brings out the worst in people. And you tend to blame people. You only need some bloke on telly saying, let's make something great again. You know, that's all you need, you know, to inspire you. And it's his fault, or it's his fault, or it's the Mexicans' fault, it's all the Muslims' fault. You know, and that's all they want. And it's all about power. You know, wake up. Wake up. John.
No one listening to this, nobody out there, no everyday British person or working class person ever benefited from the British Empire. And nobody in America, everyday fellas and ladies, ever benefited from the behemoth of a superpower. You know, slaughtering people in El Salvador and Nicaragua never benefited you. Bombing Korea never benefited you. It's just pathetic. And you know it. This is real history, and this is just an attempt by the upper classes and their lower minions to try and enforce an imagined, you know, manner of a world that never existed onto you and me, and not actually discuss what really happened. And these bills are just another tool in that armoury, frankly.
This is what I do. If I was a teacher, I'd say we live in a wonderful country, and it's a great military might. I won't say what country, I would say we're from, just in case I upset someone. Knock it on the ear, do Lombarda. but just to let you know that the last three, four wars, five wars, if we're so great, we lost all of them.
Yeah.
Okay, let's be clear here. And young boys died in that, unnecessarily, right? And the things that they were, we were fighting for was a political issue. And the people who call that war are now not in power, and the person they wanted us to kill is still alive. So it's pointless. They don't want us saying that, John. America lost Vietnam War. No one says anything. America lost Afghanistan many times. The Russians lost...
Yeah. America and Britain can't win wars. They've got massively overfunded armed forces. They can't win a war to save their life.
And then they... This hate, and then they sell to Saudi Arabia, you know, a huge amount of God, it's horrible what's happening in Yemen. Does anyone, are they printing anything in Yemen, about Yemen lately? Because I'm reading a lot about it, but I have to look for it.
Yeah, I'm the same. It's full, it's, if it was ever on the front page, it fell off it months ago. Yeah, no one's talking about it. You're right.
I think it's a sad state of affairs when this country talks about, claps its hands about migrants and that, and you see those babies over there dying. Because of what we're selling those people to do that. I think I'm embarrassed, actually. I'm embarrassed. John?
Yeah, I agree. Look, if you know, stop pissing around and playing games here. There is nothing more dangerous than the educated working class. So if you want to be edgy, if you want to be a tough guy, don't pick on a migrant, don't pick on a Muslim, don't pick on a trans kid. Pick on the rich. Get yourself educated. Take everything they took from us. Take it back. Distribute it to everyone that needs it. Okay, this vile little system and this, you know, pathetic worship of a country has to end. It's never done you any good. It's never done me any good, and it never will. Okay. But by the way, as a subject we're talking about tonight, happy Hanukkah to everybody out there. You know, I hope you're having a good one. All right, let's plow into the union section this week because I think I'm overspit. I think I'm getting used to the idea of actually having a nice microphone, so I just want to talk all night now. But no, I don't want to crash your show, mate. So we've got 20 minutes, so let's make it count. Yeah, so a little bit of union action this week. Various bits from around the world: the Make Amazon Pay campaign and Black Friday international strike action. So the past Black Friday saw an unprecedented level of industrial action around the world against Amazon for their widespread violation of workers' rights and their unregulated power. This was reported to be the largest mobilisation against Amazon in history, with actions by workers in over 20 countries around the world. With a combination of worker strikes, solidarity protests and climate activists around Europe joining the protests, blockading dozens of Amazon sweatshops in solidarity with the striking Amazon workers. So far, Amazon are doing their usual deflection. They talked about where they can improve and all this weak shit, but never really addressing issues like overwork, mass surveillance, union busting and their terrible environmental impact. Just a load of management speak, like always. Basically, they have not committed to changing anything whatsoever. Make Amazon Pay is part of a global workers' justice alliance and a huge number of organisations revolving around international union organisations, climate justice, tax watchdogs and the likes of Ethical Consumer. UNI Global Union and the Progressive International are leading this, and Amazon has tentacles in so many areas and operates a global supply chain. But of course, this is not really in-house. There are so many aspects delegated out, and this is worth paying attention to because this is where the supply chain can be affected. Companies delivering their goods, even now they have their own delivery infrastructure. We're still doing it, for instance. Distribution centres, logistics to get the gear around the world. Nevertheless, they're still using outside sources. Make Amazon Pay Coalition demands Amazon pays its workers fairly and respects their rights to join unions, pays its fair share of taxes and commits to real environmental sustainability. We tend to already over-focus on Europe and America on these things, but there's plenty happening in other parts of the globe, not least the Global South. So let's take a little look at, well, many of the actions, in fact, that were announced. Let's go through them all. In India, the Hawkers Joint Action Committee did street protests across the country to protest Amazon's threat to their local sustainable markets. This was joined by delivery drivers too. In South Africa, the Lesbic Action Campaign protested Amazon's plans to construct a megalomaniac regional headquarters on sacred Kaol land. Pardon me if I didn't pronounce that right, it's K-H-O-I. Kathmandu, organisers from the Unicom Nepal, on Unicom Nepal and UNI Nepal Liaison Council, protested in defence of Amazon's suppliers and their rights to decent conditions. Coming back over to Europe, in Berlin, warehouse workers and delivery drivers took action on the site of Amazon's HQ to launch the Amazon Workers Against Surveillance. This also, similar kind of stuff, took place in France and in Italy. And in the UK, there were protests outside the London offices of Amazon. In Toronto, over there in lovely old Canada, postal workers and the Warehouse Worker Resource Centre will march on the, or did march, I think, on the Brampton Amazon facility to demand better wages. Then Buenos Aires, Argentina's action in the Acción oil refinery against Amazon's services to fossil fuel corporations like BP. And then back to Europe, Warsaw, a broad coalition of unions and environmentalists took to the streets to protest Amazon's worker repression and arbitrary firings at its warehouses. Bangladesh and Cambodia also saw protests by garment workers. In Cambodia, the protests specifically related to a closed factory in Phnom Penh over demands for the $3.6 million severance pay that is owed to workers and yet to be paid. This year alone, Amazon has been exposed as reporting up to £8.2 trillion of the UK sales in Luxembourg to dodge their UK taxes, requiring almost 1,000 ambulance call-outs to their UK fulfilment centres, sweatshops, since 2018, including 178 call-outs to its site in Tilbury, Essex, where a male employee actually died about a month or so ago. Sacking tech workers for speaking out in solidarity with warehouse workers' unsafe conditions and deploying one of the most intrusive and pervasive systems of workplace surveillance that the world has ever known. Amazon has a global empire, and that requires a global response. Amazon is responsible for the destruction of jobs, livelihoods and biodiversity. Make Amazon pay calls for fair pay, fair taxes and less impact on the planet. Bezos is no better than a robber baron, never mind his space mission bullshit. It's time he paid for his actions to the people who put him in the position of the megalomaniac who abuses workers that he's in now and destroys the world for his own gain, because he and Elon Musk, and I will never tire of saying it, are deeply twisted, sick little individuals who really keep me awake at night knowing how much unaccounted power they have. War on Want noted recently that Italian workers won their first national collective agreement with Amazon after they came together across job roles and employment contracts to take action in nationwide strikes. Today, workers and their trade unions across the world are gearing up to do the same. The campaign continues, and anyone wanting to donate to make Amazon pay for their future actions can do so. Again, there'll be a link in the show description, or help in any other way. I will look to gain an interview from someone there as soon as I can, although obviously with, it's a very large grouping, so I'd probably be looking to find somewhere like, I don't know, UNI Global Union and whoever's in their liaison with Make Amazon Pay. I don't know. Few more stories. Dave, should I go through all these stories, or do you want to feed back on each individual one? What do you think?
Well, it's just a classic case of... what people got to understand about trade union reps, 9 times out of 10, unpaid volunteers. We do have laws about trade unions as well, and they're there for a reason. They've been slowly chipped away over the decades, but ultimately, the right to organise is slowly being chipped away politically, and focus is being put in the House of Commons and the mainstream media on... migrants and things like that, and bad weather, and obviously the COVID thing has deviated from society's ability to punish the people that make them what they are. And we're the biggest majority working people. We don't realise that. We're a huge majority. And every 4 years we get to vote, they absolutely cack themselves, the establishment. And all this is stopping people from organising and having decent pay. That's all. It's not much to ask. And they're not doing it to stop unions because they're evil, or because the mainstream media will say that the general secretary's on 100 grand, look at that, and all his members are out on strike and he still gets 100 grand. There's a lot more to the general secretary. There's 5 or 6 members that negotiate for that company. Yes, 9, 7 times out of 10 they are paid, But they live outside from a suitcase, and they could be going different parts of the country, and they see their families probably once or twice a week. And then there's the people on the ground who are unpaid, you know. So why would you stop that? Why would you stop people from... Is it the same reason why you don't want things educated, put, you know, kids learning the truth in schools? We got to take a step back and think. Think. John?
I will never apologise for union members making good wages. People and companies and organisations who underpay their staff and try to prevent them from joining unions, you should be apologising. You should be deeply ashamed of yourselves. But I'm never going to back down on the union issue, okay? That's why they hate us. It's because we're effective. And I've got a couple of little stories, one of which even just came out today as I was finishing writing the show today, that I'm going to come to in a little while. But absolutely, this is the stuff that happens. So to give you an example, right, I'll go straight into the next one because I think it's relevant here. The next story I was going to talk about is UNI Global Union affiliates from around the world united for a global action day on the 17th of November to demand that governments and retailers take action to end violence and harassment in commerce. There's been a dramatic increase of third-party, or customer specifically, violence towards workers across the retail sector, from supermarkets to fashion stores, according to the UNI Global Union. And according to UNI, more than 100 representatives from 30 countries took part on the 17th of November in a global webinar organised by UNI's commerce sector to tackle this issue. The participants made a number of interesting points, all of this in an attempt to end this kind of customer violence. So Steve Applebaum from the UNI Commerce President and President of the Retail, Wholesale and Department Store Union in the United States explained how the US culture of the customer is always right has led to a sense of entitlement from customers and the feeling among workers that this must change. Combined with pandemic stress and the politicisation of mask wearing, this attitude has led to a spike in violence in commerce. It has even escalated to workers being shot and killed by some customers. Kenta Ando from the Japanese union UA Zensen reported how retail workers' requests for people to wear masks have been repeatedly met with outright refusal from customers as well as abusive language. His union successfully lobbied the Japanese government into taking significant measures to protect retail workers. New guidelines to deal with customer harassment drawn up in consultation with the union and set for release in February 2022. A bit far away from my liking, but nevertheless, legislation is what it's all about, and this is what you get with union action. You need something sorted, this is what we do. Australian representative Gerald Dwyer of the SDA union talked about the survey of retail workers that found 1 in 5 has been deliberately spat at or coughed on during the pandemic. Again, the union has played a major role in tackling this kind of customer violence with a public awareness campaign. Swedish representative talked about the large number of women in retail there reporting sexual harassment, and the Handels union is now including clauses in their collective agreements to help prevent this abuse. While the Hungarian retail union KASZ revealed 80% of retail workers had experienced physical violence from customers with little to no support from their managers. In fact, in some cases, I think they said 14% of managers were reported as saying the customer was right. Now, I want to draw attention to all this because obviously it's important to prevent workers being abused while doing their jobs, and I'm happy to see some successes in tackling this. Again, union action brings results. But also because this is something we should pay a lot more attention to for any number of reasons. But no doubt this is also happening to delivery workers, many of whom work in the terrible and unregulated sector built on gross exploitation. We can challenge this and end it, but we must demand respect from customers wherever they are, and workers are not obliged in any way to tolerate abuse from customers, managers or anyone else. I think both me and Dave can't underline that any harder. You know, from a trade union perspective, you are not obliged to be abused. It's not part of the job. It's not in your contract. And if it is in your contract, tear the sodding thing up and walk away. Dave.
I'm seeing a huge amount of people approach me from outside the normal representations that I do. And you know something's going on because the calls start intensifying. It's once a month, then it's once a week, and it's once a day. I'm getting sorts of contracts given to me via email. And what I have to do, and I'm not trying to indoctrinate people. All I'm saying is, here is the union that is affiliated to your industry. You need to join that union. There are experts on there that will help you with this stuff. I'll guide you, but I don't know the ins and outs of your business because we're quite a diverse range of industry in the UK. And you'll mostly find that that union affiliated to your industry know pretty much how your how it works, alongside legal stuff that your employer probably wouldn't know, but the trade union does. Joe?
Yeah, your employer often doesn't know these things, which is one of my favourite parts of ever being in a room, especially if you're representing someone in an area that they don't normally have union reps in. It's just great fun to, like, if you read this contract that you actually, you know, is part of, this agreement, rather, that's part of your company, and the kind of look of complete terror in their eyes is really makes my day, if not year.
Well, I did challenge an employer once outside the industry, and they said, no, that's a correct contract. That's legally right, and he had the gall to say it's morally right. So, obviously, as union reps, you know, you push them back a little bit. Well, have you got a contract like that? What's your contract? Well, that's confidential. So you're saying this contract's legal? Well, it was given to me to give to that person. So it's not legal. And we're sitting in here bouncing that around. I said, this meeting's over.
Yeah,
we're not signing a new contract. All right? And then and I'll be looking at challenges in the tribunal. On this. And incidentally, the tribunal is backed up with cases like this. They're 2 years behind, okay? So we're not lying here, John.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we could fill this show with a number of stories of these kind of experiences. I think you've got substantially more than I have, but I've got a few too. But I tell you what, eye on the time. I'd like to just have a little bit of a chit chat at the end if I can, Dave. So I just want to knock out this last couple of bits, and then we can just all kind of feedback. IWGB News, we love you people. Come on the show. Just Eat Stuart workers striking. So workers at Stuart, a subsidy of the DPD Group, are facing a 25% pay cut, and this has led to strike action planned via the IWGB Delivery Drivers Union. Demanding pay. IWGB, by the way, has membership of a lot of people all over, but this is particularly their delivery drivers division. And the union is demanding a pay rise, dignity and respect, plus paid waiting times, after 10 minutes. They are backed by Sheffield Labour MP Olivia Blake, and the strike will begin from the 6th of December. Bat Hador, one of the striking drivers, says, in the pandemic, when the NHS were helping people, we were feeding people, so they could stay in their homes and not go out. While we risked our own health and that of our families, our services were never mentioned anywhere, and now they want to reduce our salaries. Is this fair? He asks. End of quote. Assuming it's a he. I'm sorry, I've made an assumption there. I have no idea. There is a strike fund, too, which I believe I've included in this week's links to go in there. And there was actually a demo. I don't know how this went. There was a demo last Sunday at the Sheffield Town Hall. I'll have to look up how that went. But, yeah, this is more important than ever. As we know from our work directly, the delivery sector has become, as I said earlier on, an under-regulated wasteland for workers' rights. But we are seeing increasing numbers of workers standing up and fighting back, and we should support them in every way. We'll be checking in with all of the actions around this, and who knows, maybe we'll even get an interview. Okay, so we're going to go out on a couple of wins. Country Road Workers, Australia. After 12 days of strike action, Country Road Workers have won. Members of the United Workers Union voted to return to work after securing an agreement that includes an increased pay rise, job security and recognition for their chosen union. These predominantly women workers from the Melbourne warehouse won the fight through a series of actions, including store and Melbourne Fashion Week protests. They got 13.3% EBA, including basic pay, 20 new permanent jobs, site rates for casuals, and new union rights and recognition. And also worthy of note in closing, news that arrived today is that the strike action has helped to defeat the fire and rehire activities at Clark's Shoes. We know many companies around the country here in Britain are trying to do this fire and rehire. Sadly, some of them have got away with it so far. But Clark's is not one of them, because their staff stood up and said, no way, we're not having it. So, lovely. Good stuff. Dave, you want to tell me what you think of all of that.
Solidarity to the university lecturers taking industrial action. Never a first thing. It's always the last for pay and pensions. Solidarity with you guys. That's 3 days those poor members will be taking. Because I know the world's changed and, you know, home learning and stuff, I get that. But from what I see, it's a blatant liberty taking because of that. It's just a lot, you know, it's just a liberty take, actually. And you haven't even negotiated with these people. Get yourselves on the table and negotiate this thing. Don't be hiding behind silly letters. If you're the other side of this argument, get yourself on the table because they're ready to negotiate. Because it's all about negotiation, John.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, shout out to ACAS because they were involved in the Clark's decision and finding a way. Yeah, I mean, what have we learned tonight, folks? Well, we've learned you need to be in a trade union. We've learned you need to stop hating on migrants and refugees and asylum seekers because it doesn't do you any good and it's horrible. And we've also learned that good microphones make for a far more interactive and upbeat person in your presenter. So, but other things we've learned is that basically we have to take these things. We've said it before, we'll say it again. We have to organise, we have to get together, we have to take what is ours, and it's the only way we're ever going to win, you know, simple as that. Just a couple of things in the closing minutes, Dave, unless you want to feedback on that. I was just going to say that I don't know exactly what the next couple of weeks are going to look like. I've got some possible interviews, or it'll just be you and me, that's fine. But I should think, if you're free for it, that on the 22nd of December, Christmas week, we should do our annual Christmas music show, I imagine, where I play you a bizarre and intricate level of Christmas music that, despite absolutely detesting this season, I end up finding really cool and interesting music if I dig.
I'm on the same page. Look, it's the last year, and I think the year before, but definitely recently. I can't even remember what Christmas it was, John, but it was really some really bluesy, reggae-type music, and I just cannot, will not. I mean, I know we do the tracks, Christmas songs that come on, but they're sort of R&B, hip-hop. But I just, if I hear that one song, and it's interesting, I saw a meme the other day where they're going to ban Fairy Tale in New York, which I like, actually.
Beautiful song, one of the most beautiful songs ever written.
Yeah, in national radio, they find, we can't play Fairy Tale in New York because it's offensive. Here's Cardi B talking about her fanny.
Someone else said that to me earlier, actually, yeah. Look, I just got to say, that's another trope that really annoys me. No one ever shut down Fairy Tale in New York, okay? Someone suggested it at some BBC meeting while, you know, they were waiting for, I don't know, Laura Koonsberg to wake up or something. And it's never actually been done. All of the stations, they always play the original. No one's banning your song. Believe me, if anyone should care about this, it's me, because that's actually one of my favourite songs from my absolute favourite band forever. It's utter crap, okay? Stop believing this fake culture war bullshit.
It's because it's Irish, John. It's because it's Irish.
Well, there's that too, yeah.
That's all that, it obviously. Is. It's because it's Irish. And who cares what national radio are going to play anyway?
Well, yeah, exactly. Why are you listening to the radio? There's sod all good music on there most of the time anyway. Why are you listening to that crap? If you're listening to cool underground shit.
Oh.
In fact, you check out I only found this last year, and I didn't include any tracks at the time, but it's slowly growing, maybe slowly growing on me, is the MF Doom Christmas album. You know, that's pretty cool, actually. You should check that out. And I never liked Doom that much when he was around, but I'm growing. I do dip in and out of his stuff, and I grow a greater appreciation of it. But yeah, God, seriously, check out our show. We're going to just bring you some stonking music. It's going to be so cool.
I look forward to it, John. Many thanks, and we'll catch up next week, brother.
Nice one, mate. Yeah, thanks again as ever. And I just hope this microphone sounds as lovely as I think it does.
It does. It does indeedy.
Sorry for the terrible mics, everyone.
Cheers.